Shields. I'm the state representative from Northeast. Subcommittee introductions, yes. So before I get to some opening remarks, I just wanted to have everybody on the committee introduce themselves and perhaps say a word or two about any particular interest they might have in the realm of public safety. Senator?
Thank you. Senator Ben Weston, District 27, functionally Deschutes County. I'm very pleased to be here and was just elated when the committee assignments came out and I was once again serving on the Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee. This is one of the most interesting is too vague a word. It's one of the most critical, involved, impactful budgetary processes we have in the state of Oregon, and it affects so many lives. It is one of the reasons that we all need to give our best efforts in this committee. And as we just recently saw in the presentation in Hearing Room F with regard to the meth addicted family and the justice system, there's a lot of work that we can do to further what we all think is a best efficacy when it comes to many of the problems facing the state. I appreciate you having me, Chairman. Thank you.
I'm Nancy Nathanson from District 13, which is North Eugene. I was on the Eugene City Council for three consecutive terms, 12 years, and as a member of the Eugene City Council, we covered, as you can expect, just like state government, general purpose government, involved in many different aspects and all aspects of municipal government. But the thing that I think was especially helpful and why I became very interested in public safety and also the nexus between public safety and human services or social services is I served for two different terms on our Intergovernmental Human Services Commission, which had the unpleasant task of divvying up a shrinking pie, shrinking resources to serve increasing needs. And then I also served as our city's representative to the Public Safety Coordinating Council for a while. So that is where I got a real passion for seeing how the criminal justice system does and does not function well as a system, and how as a society we can work better on human services prevention, treatment, health, and education, which directly impact the public safety in people's lives. Are we safe in our homes, in our neighborhoods?
Good afternoon, Representative Bruce Hanna, District 7, vast portions of Lane and Northern Douglas County. Had the good fortune to serve in this very subcommittee during the last session, so I have a great deal of interest in being back and feel fortunate to do so. I believe public safety to be one of the very cores of functions of government, and therefore find this quite important. I had the pleasure of being here before, so I'm looking forward to carrying that information forward and applying it as we work ourselves with all the agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jeff Barker. I represent Beaverton and Alola area, House District 28. I've served on the Judiciary Committee. This will be my third session on Judiciary Committee, and last session I was chairman of the Criminal Law Subcommittee. I've also was involved in law enforcement for over 31 years as everything from trooper and police officer up through lieutenant and foreman when I retired. And I have family that's still involved in law enforcement, and I'm just really interested in this subject. Look forward to trying to get things running smoothly here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barker. Senator Nelson, would you like to introduce yourself?
David Nelson, state senator from Pendleton. I represent four counties out in northeastern Oregon. I'm just happy to be sitting on the committee.
Thanks. Senator Burdick?
Yeah, I'm Senator Ginny Burdick from Southwest Portland, Tiger King City, and part of Bull Mountain in Washington County, and I am chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and requested this committee even before I found out that Representative Shields was chair. And now I'm especially delighted to be here because of the obvious nexus between criminal justice policy and budgetary concerns. And so I'm very happy to be here. I did serve on this subcommittee while also being a minority member of judiciary in 1999. Found it to be very useful to be both on the policy and budget side of things.
Good. And, you know, when Senator Nolan and Representative Nolan and Senator Schrader brought us together for the first time, I think Representative Nolan hit it well on the head that we need to be asking ourselves, are we doing the right things and are we doing things right? And I think from this committee's viewpoint, I'm hoping we'll have a broad view of what public safety is. That's prisons, jails, troopers, sheriffs, DAs, public defense, judges, the military. But it's also drug and alcohol treatment, emergency communication, mental health, Head Start, early interventions, secondary interventions, and prisoner reentry, because no matter how many people we lock up, the fact is that 95% of them will be coming back to our community someday. And for every one person we have locked up, we have at least three who are under supervision and maybe another two or three who are no longer under supervision but are former offenders in the community. As some of you know, I started an outfit called Better People that helps hold offenders accountable and helps them change their behavior. And so that's one of the things that I'll bring to the table, some expertise in how to get people to change. And I'm hoping to use the expertise of all of you in moving forward to both improve public safety and save taxpayer dollars in this committee. When I worked at Better People and I used to facilitate groups with offenders and people who are in recovery from addiction, offenders would often come to us with excuses on why they couldn't do things, why they couldn't do this or that. And they'd say, well, you know, rules are made to be broken. And we'd say, no, rules are made to be followed. And that's how I hope to run this committee, by the notion that rules are made to be followed. So I do anticipate that we'll start on time and that we'll be out of here no later than 4:30 each day. And since this is my first time chairing a committee, I plan to run it by the book so that if you could please, if you have questions, direct them through the chair. And also, when people are making their presentations, I'd prefer that they get all the way through their presentation, if at all possible, before we start barraging them with questions. So with that, let's get started.
Mr. Chair, other introductions, Sue Cook behind us, CSR committee assistant, and my name is Doug Wilson. I'm the scheduler and the coordinator for the LFO staff, even though you'll see three other LFO staff staffing this at various times. What I'd like to do quickly do, some are pros at Ways and Means, some are new to the process, so what we're doing today or the organizational meeting is quickly going through some topics which are laid out in the packet in front of you. There's the first sheet is the one I'll walk through. The other sort of are supporting documents to that. If you cannot make a meeting, please call on the first bullet there our scheduling clerk, Lynn, and the phone number is given there. We would like to know if you're coming or not coming. One reason for that is just the quorum requirements, which I'll get to in a second here. We have rather tight quorum requirements, and if we're taking votes if you are taking votes as a subcommittee, it's going to be tight if someone's missing. And on the Senate side for a couple weeks, it will be tighter because of Senator Winters being out. Subcommittee rules, if you look in your packet, there is the Ways and Means rules. I definitely won't go through there. A couple things apply to the subcommittees in there. One is the quorum. If you turn to the second page, second piece of paper, you'll see that even 10 members on this subcommittee, five on each body, that's significantly more than it's been in the past. And the quorum is three from each side, a majority from both the House and the Senate, both for the quorum and for voting things out of this committee.
couple special requirements or special things that the co-chairs can, either co-chair can come in and vote as a member of the subcommittee or act as part of the subcommittee, and the vice chairs of Ways and Means can act in the same way, but both the Senate co-chair and the Senate vice chair cannot be voting in the same at the same time. On the House side, it's a little more complicated since Representative Nicholson is the vice chair, but also member or a member of the subcommittee. It really only applies to Representative Nolan on that side and not the vice chair on those rules. Nothing else on rules unless there's questions. Other issues in terms of meeting operations, to the audience with Little's here today about pagers, cell phones, electronic devices, if they become a nuisance, we'll run out there and tell you that. Please be silent, or have one of the retired troopers take care of it. Both of them have left the room.
Yeah, but they're right outside.
And they are armed.
Mr. Chair, a question for staff.
Yes, Senator.
Why does the vice chair rule apply to Representative Nathanson, vice chair, and not Ben Westland as vice chair?
It would be the vice chair of the full committee is where what I was referring to, Mr. Chair, Senator Westland.
I understand. Thank you.
Roll calls will be used when in doubt, but generally in Ways and Means we don't use roll call very often. I don't remember more than two or three times in the past two sessions I've been here, but my memory might be slipping. While it says the microphones are sensitive and may pick up side communications, at the same time the people are sharing microphones, so if you're going to make a question or talk for a while, please turn the mic in front of you to yourself. Part of the issue, probably everyone out there can hear you, but it's the tape that we need to worry about. And Sue will remind us if she can't hear through her system. Meeting notices, 72 hours for the first posting, 48 hours if it's a continued posting. Bills can be carried forward to the next day if actions have not been completed without following those 72 or 48 hour rules. There will be a daily agenda, which I think is in front of you. I will also try to distribute either on Thursday or Friday a weekly agenda out to you. I did via over the weekend email. We will try to deliver it to your office. We'll give you an idea what's coming up. There's a list in your packet. I put the weekly agenda in the packet. There's a list of bills, agencies, and staffing in your packet. Feel free to call any of the legislative fiscal staff if you have questions about particular budgets that are listed under them. If they're in doubt or if it's a general public safety question, please give me a call. I'm willing to run anywhere in the building and meet with you. Don't want to run too far away from the building, but be glad to sit down with you at any point in time, and I'm sure any of the other analysts would be. In the next sheet in the packet, which is headed on our stationary Ways and Means process items, there's a couple items here. There are three stages or three types of agencies that will be heard in this, and this is something new to try to speed up the process in some cases and get to the meaty issues. There are sort of three levels of hearings and agencies. The first level is called expedient. Thank you. Having a mental block there. And these are for agencies that have very relatively simple budgets, may only be coming in at the essential budget level and not have any packages, policy packages added to them. The expectation is they would still meet, come forward, submit their performance measures for review, and their program prioritization information. But there wouldn't be the longer presentations. There would be time for public testimony, and the agency's budget issues would only be dealt with in work session. The hope is to get a few of these through the process and waiting on the floors around March 1st so there are budgets to be heard when the law or the more often floor sessions take place. The benefit to the agency is, and I'll get to the 2% reprioritization effort in the middle, but they would not be subject to that. I was tempted to put corrections under the under this category to avoid large 2% reductions, but I don't think they would qualify, and the co-chairs would probably not appreciate that. But in this subcommittee, we're taking a look at the parole board. Even though it's all almost all general fund, it is a relatively simple budget, and the Judicial Fitness Commission under this category, and we would likely hear those next week. Second level of hearings, slightly more complex agency or budgets, may have simplistic policy packages or only one or two issues that have to be dealt with. Maybe a little longer set of hearings, public testimony, but hopefully those would move through faster also. I'm not sure what agencies qualify from that, but we'll work through that. And then the third level are the usual budget hearing levels that we've had in the past. And to be honest, given the complexity of the issues of many of these agencies and the size of the budgets and the extent of the general fund in most of your agencies, except maybe the two we talked about, are likely to be in that third category. If you turn that page over, or both of the pages sort of working off of, the co-chairs have introduced and are putting in place a our 2% reprioritization effort. This is outlined in these pages. I will also pass out, I don't mind passing that down, some budget numbers for the agencies in this, where this comes into play. What we as staff, along with the subcommittee chairs, are supposed to identify 2% savings in each of the, or in the budgets, and that's 2% from the essential budget level, and which half of those savings will be retained by the subcommittee and half will be passed on to the co-chairs for reprioritization. This is not only general and lottery funds, it also applies to other funds and federal funds, recognizing that most other funds and federal funds have specific purposes, and there are some choices outlined here on what you could do with that, with those funds. It does not apply to non-limited expenditures, of which there are some in this subcommittees, but it does apply to debt service, even though you can't cut debt service. And in an agency like Corrections, which now has $130 million of debt service in their budget, it is a sizable chunk. The sheet that I gave you, the 2% targets, are on the far right-hand box of those. So, like for Corrections, the 2% threshold or target is $25.2 million, which represents over half of the total amount that have to be identified. I will work with the sub-chair in finding those and work with the agencies. Must note that that you don't necessarily have to take the 2% from equal amounts from the agencies. It can be, if you can find $30 million in Department of Corrections, excuse me if anyone from Corrections is here, I'm using you as an example, or you can take more or less out of an agency. The important thing is the bottom line for the co-chairs at this stage. And I think we'll get into more of that in the future as we come to the first agency that this applies to. Quickly moving on here, since many of you have sat through a long two-hour meeting before this on public safety. The tentative order of budget presentations are there on the other sheet. The two first ones are small judicial branch agencies, which are probably going to be heard next Monday, Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, since it's one of those first-stage agencies, hopefully. Will be heard soon after that, and then it follows through. Interspersed in there, there may be a hearing or two for sure on January 30th. There will be a hearing regarding prison population and alternatives and sort of the consequences of the growing prison population. The plan right now is to bring down an expert from the state of Washington who works for their legislature there in a research capacity. Craig, the name is Steve Arrows.
Ose,
excuse me. And Criminal Justice Commission, Craig Prinz will be doing some presenting, and I think Portland State University may be part of that too. So that will be during this time slot on the 30th, next Tuesday.
If you could tell your staff to schedule you till 5 o'clock, that particular meeting might go a little bit longer.
I'm sorry, the date on
that? That's going to be 23rd. January 30th.
Which is next Tuesday.
Yeah.
Keep in mind that the order here is a tentative order. It may change based on a number of factors, and it is not necessarily a work session order. Prioritization process, I do not want to get into a lot of detail here. I would rather use the example of an agency, but I think that was discussed last week or the week before in Full Ways and Means. Just please keep in mind that small agencies may only have one or two programs, so it's a little hard to prioritize compared to a state police or a Department of Corrections, which has numerous programs and activities. Performance measures, again, I won't go into a lot of depth in there. You've had some briefing, and it's probably best to, when the subcommittee gets to a point where they deal with it specifically in an agency, to go through the process then. In terms of other budget process, as you work through work session, there's a packet in your packet. There's a clipped amount. These are some materials from last biennium that I just set out here. Some Criminal Justice Commission. Craig, please don't get nervous. We're not going to work session your budget right now. But anyways, the process will be there. I will present a memo at work session. In some cases, the memo will go through some of the activities of the agency, because the process going through here right now, it's either been a long time period since you heard the agency's budget, or there may be some things that I think need to be brought forward as issues. Along with that memo, the second package in there is our standardized work session financial report. We'll walk through this. This has sort of the building blocks of the budget by fund type and all the packages that you will need to act on as a subcommittee, and it's usually done by divisions within an agency or budget units. In this case, I think there were two budget units in the Criminal Justice Commission. Some agencies, like state police, will have up to 10 or 12 divisions that you will need to walk through. And this you go through rather quickly. I think we've work sessioned the Department of Corrections budget and state police in one meeting, so I can walk through quickly as long as the issues are not contentious. The next, for those that are relatively new to the Ways and Means process or new to the legislation, the next thing in that packet is a budget report. Important to note, this is not law, but it is sort of a guide to agencies and others in terms of budget, what the expectations are. It's also a summary document that's used on the floor and in full committee. If you would turn to page 5 of 7 in that budget report, the budget note process, most of you understand that. Budget notes do not have the force of law, but agencies tread carefully in not following the requirements of budget note. Generally, they are followed. I can only think of a couple times that they have not been, in my experience, both in the executive and the legislative branch. Generally, the process, hopefully, for budget notes are that you first talk to the subcommittee chair to make sure that he is in the loop on any budget notes, and then the co-chairs must approve and sign off, each of the co-chairs, on budget notes before they can be submitted for a vote in the subcommittee. And I would also suggest that if you have budget notes, we can get it in the proper language to bring, also run through me or the agency analyst for that particular agency. It just makes it easier. It makes us, sometimes we're brought in to explain it to the co-chairs on what it's doing. So it's best to keep us in the loop if you don't mind doing that. The other items in that packet, there's a pony The ponies are basically floor speeches. Some committees do this, some committees don't. It's been a long-standing tradition that that a pony is written for the full committee as well as the floor, and we will adjust those between the setting that it needs to be. You can either read this. We strongly encourage that you either read it or paraphrase it to get things on the record, and then if you wish to embellish and add to it, go ahead and do it. But it, we do want to make sure certain things get on the record in the full committee and on the floor. The next item is just a sample amendment. Ways and Means bills are rather short compared to other bills, and there's a proposed amendment which is actually was voted on by the House. And the last item is a Ways and Means bill, and I took a rather complicated one in this case. Unfortunately, I only copied on one page. This is the state police budget bill from last session. Some budget bills will only have a couple lines to them if it's a general fund only agency in a single unit. Others will be more complicated where you divide up the appropriations into budget units, like is done here. And then the only other thing is other subcommittee work. You'll see the budget-related fee bills. In this case, you'll probably see one for, I have not, now thinking about it, seen any fee bills for any of these agencies yet, as at least submitted by the governor. You'll likely see in the past for the fire marshal, state police in some cases. But that's about it. Most of public safety agencies do not have fees of any type. And the last thing I want to, or then there's federal grant application requests that may flow through this. By law, an agency cannot apply for a federal grant without the authority of the legislature. It's usually the E-Board during interim and the full Ways and Means Committee during session. And then toward the end of session, you'll see legislation that has fiscal impact that flows through the committee, sometimes with the budget and sometimes separated from the budget, depending on the timing. And the last thing I want to mention, Mr. Chair, members, is because of the way the presentations will be formatted this time, you'll have less background material on an agency. For example, if corrections comes forward, you won't hear the in-depth discussion of how things are done, what the consequences are. It'll be more around performance measures, and there'll be less in budget building than there has been in the past. So it's our recommendation that that I think all of you got a copy of this last Friday, or it was delivered to your office. I would suggest you read the analysis in there for each agency a day or two before, if you haven't already, for that agency to get you that background and get you the introduction to the into the issues in the budget as well as the policy issues. So with that, Mr. Chair, that is all I have.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. A couple of other items. One, if you have people that you would suggest for expert testimony, please feel free to forward their names to me, and I'd be happy to consider them. Additionally, if you have ideas for where we should have road hearings, I'm hoping that we'll have two or three of those over the course of the session. Representative Cameron and I have already talked about trying to find a head start in his district that might reflect kind of the broad view of public safety and how we can intervene in crimes and keep them from happening in the first place. So that's one area or idea that we're working on. Questions, anyone? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. My question is about operations versus capital construction. I've been part of budget presentations in the past where sometimes agency by agency or program by program, you'll hear operations and then capital construction. I've also participated in hearings or work sessions where all of the operations were done, and then capital construction was an entirely separate thing. How will we expect to hear those this time?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, first of all, there are no capital construction limitation authority in the operations budget bill. There will be a separate bill. In some cases, it will be a separate bill that is run by a different committee, because generally we put them all in one place. higher ed may have a separate bill. But as part of the presentations by the committees, that will be presented at the same time as operations. It will be woven into that, where you will see capital construction. Corrections will have a little bit this time, nothing like in the past, because they're not having to come forward for money other than planning for a prison. OYA will have a little deferred maintenance along with corrections, but your big one will be the Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, or OWIN, which is a substantial amount of capital construction this time. Will be one of the big issues you will have to deal with.
For the record, can I just say, when Mr. Wilson says substantial, that's an understatement. It's a lot of money, folks.
Yes. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to clarify on the 2% reduction that they're going through. I wasn't sure I heard you correctly. The debt burden from the Department of Corrections, is that included in the base in which they must make the 2%?
So we brought that forward to the co-chairs, but they decided at this time to include it. The only things that are not included are the non-limited other federal funds, which in this case are grant funds that pass through generally to local governments. So
that's where I heard you. I just want to make sure I heard correctly. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up on Senator Burdick's question. When the co-chairs made the decision on the 2% return, so to speak, do you know, and maybe staff knows, whether there's any conversation whether a portion of that went back to the agency? One might consider it somewhat motivational if agencies benefit by the fact that they're able to help us find dollars that are non-essential, so we say. And I didn't know how expanded that conversation was.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I wasn't part of the conversations. My understanding is the 1% that you retain as a subcommittee, you can invest where you wish as a subcommittee. And I think the others are the co-chairs. We'll be taking a look at the overall set of priorities. And I think, you know, to be honest, what I've heard in some cases from some folks are that maybe some of the things that the governor funds in his budget with non-general resources, maybe that's where some of those funds will end up, with general fund resources at least.
Hello.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think my point is that agencies might be more willing to help us find non-essential dollars if they benefit from that. And so I will certainly have that conversation with the co-chairs. Mr. Chair, another question. Scheduling, and I don't know to what extent we're going to be going on the road or going past 4:30, but the sooner we know in terms of calendaring, it's much more beneficial in terms of our ability to attend, at least in terms of scheduling other meetings and stuff. So if there's anything else coming soon down the pike, we'd sure appreciate knowing about it.
We'll make sure you know as soon as we know.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, on sort of tours and stuff, even though I don't think anything other than the 30th has been set in concrete. If you do want to have any tours, and it's late afternoon is not a great time to do tours in some areas, but if you'd rather, would you like to do something on your own or do like a ride-along with a straight trooper or something like that, I'll be glad to help you set that up and have your office contact me, and I'll get the agency to contact your office and set that kind of thing up.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One other issue that I think everyone should be mindful of when we look at the 2% piece are those agencies where we deal with dedicated funds, dedicated funding, and Doug, maybe you can elaborate on this, but where you save money from a dedicated fund, what can you give it back to? So there's a bit of an issue there that I'm not sure is completely resolved. Maybe,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, if you take, for example, the fire marshal fees, they can only be used for a special purpose. So we're supposed to identify the savings there, but you cannot use those fees over in some other part of state police or Department of Corrections. So your choices are reinvest them back into an eligible activity, let the ending balance grow a little bit, or if it's large enough, even talk about reducing the fee.
Yeah.
So there are, and the federal funds are even more complicated than that at times.
Good question.
Follow-up was simply to the idea that even the, some of the discussion we had in looking at this was that there was a possibility that the only way to give back a dedicated fund, in an example, was to reduce a fee, which becomes complicated, and then in terms of legislative management, could be quite cyclical in the way it's approached. I just think we all want to be cautious when we go searching for that 2% piece, where we get it and how you readminister where that's going.
Fair point. Representative Nathanson.
The response left me with another question. If money is left in an ending fund balance, that I assume that could be spent legally in a subsequent cycle on that activity, but it couldn't be after that budget term. It couldn't then be used for other activities because it had been collected for the dedicated purpose. So how do you keep track then of what's left in the ending fund? Does it become sort of like a mini reserve fund for that service?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, basically the accounting system for the state and the budget system keeps track of the ending balances. You're right, it acts as a reserve. It also acts as a cash flow because in many cases fees may come in, as is a good example, once a year or once a biennium, except they need that money during that time period. So it is built up as that reserve fund. You always want to keep a certain amount of months months of spending in your reserve fund, an amount equal to that for cash flow purposes. I'm not sure if I answered your question.
One more question from Senator Nelson, and then we'll dive into the presentation.
I'm just having a conflict or an issue, and I think this is a very interesting budget because they're all basically related. And we talk about inputs and outcomes. I would like us to consider another thing called impacts, because if we raise the amount of state troopers on the highway, we will be probably looking at more indigent defenders, more prisons, more prison guards, more. They're going to have a rollout effect rather than a roll-up effect. Will this committee be looking at that?
Good question. Done.
Carefully is the answer.
Yes, carefully. Senator Nelson, I mean, it's up to staff to point out those impacts. It's up to members of the subcommittee to recognize them, that they're there. I mean, that's sort of the purpose of the hearing earlier, was to try to convince you of the interactivity or the interrelationship of public safety, probably more so than many other areas. The budget, human services is another example where there's a lot of
one thing is the
networking and stuff. So, and that's a point that we have as staff over the past few biennia trying to make sure that people understand.
And it is.
I mean, you use a good example, but the interconnectivity is very strong in public safety.
Well, should we go ahead and get started? Linda Gilbert, could you please come forward from Budget and Management Division of DAS?
Yes. Mr. Chair, let me just set the stage, if that's all right. Considering we had sort of long hearings this afternoon and again in the morning, for those that can make it, today's agenda is rather short. But there were a couple items that I thought should be brought forward. One is the criminal fines and assessment that Linda Gilbert from Budget Management will present, and the other was sentencing guidelines. These are just sort of quick primers on these. I need to state that Linda is the primary public safety person analyst for the Budget Management Division, which is the governor's budget staff. And you'll see her at the table for many of the agencies in front of you representing the governors and the system of the agencies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, as has been noted, Linda Gilbert, Department of Administrative Services, Budget and Management. I believe you will soon have before you something that looks like this. I want to emphasize that this is a very high-level look at the criminal fine and assessment account, revenues and expenditures. The first several displays have to do with the revenue, where it comes from, and how much of it there is, and then the final displays have to do with how the revenue is allocated or expended, how it has been in the past, and how it is done in the governor's recommended budget for 07-09. On page 2, there's a narrative overview of the criminal fine and assessment account, and this is as it is effective July 1 of 2007. That's the biennium for which you will be making decisions on allocations of this particular fund. The account includes revenues that are collected by circuit courts, justice courts, and municipal courts from persons convicted of criminal offenses, violations, and infractions other than parking tickets. The current statute that will be effective, again, July 1 of 7, lays out priorities for allocating the criminal fine and assessment account funds, beginning with public safety standards facilities, which is otherwise known as DPSST, the academy, as well as some funding that goes to state police for their training unit. The second priority is compensation and assistance to crime victims. These programs are, there are about six of them, and they are administered through the Department of Human Services and through the Department of Justice. Forensic services of the Oregon State Police includes the services of the medical examiner as well. And finally, there is funding for maintenance and operation of the law enforcement data system also within state police. Dollars that are not allocated to the priorities above are distributed to the general fund. The next display on page 3 shows the circuit court revenues, and this gives an idea of the size of various sources. Clearly, the two big sources are fines and unitary assessment. Unitary assessment is on top, fines on the bottom. Together, they are about 81% of the revenue that is used. The fines are compensatory or punishment-type fines, as well as victim restitution. Unitary assessments are obligations that are like fines that are collected above regular fines or restitution by all three levels of the courts. As noted, this is only this display only covers the circuit courts. It does not cover justice courts or municipal courts. And the next display also has to do with revenue. This goes from 97.99 through 2007.09. It's in millions of dollars. The light shaded or larger bars are the revenues from the circuit courts, and the darker bars at the bottom are justice and municipal revenues. And I won't go into a lot of the legislation behind this, but as you can see, between 97.99 and 99.01, there was a fairly significant rise in the revenues, and there was legislation that modified the statutes to ensure that the state did receive its share of revenues from fines and assessments. It established minimum fine schedules. It prohibited courts from waiving a unitary assessment if they had not also waived imposition of other fines, required reductions in fees that are split between state and local governments to be applied equally, and finally allowed the Secretary of State to and the Department of Revenue to audit the courts with respect to imposing fees. So that is our final on revenues. The next display on page 5 relates to allocation. And as you see, it starts in 93-95 and goes legislatively adopted or approved budgets and goes through 2007-09, the governor's recommended budget. And there's a dot if an agency or a program received funding from CFAA in that particular biennium. The four that have consistently received it is DPSST Operations, the DOJ Criminal Injuries Compensation Account, and the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account, as well as training dollars within state police. Otherwise, these allocations have gone in a fairly wide variety of places. The next is a brief legislative history. Again, we won't go deeply into this. Before the 99 legislative session, the CFAA revenues, the distributions and percentages were established in statute for programs and for the general fund. Senate Bill 82, we have discussed, or I just discussed on page 4, added caps to the maximum distributions to programs. limited the ability of the courts to waive assessments and authorized audits. House Bill 2877 eliminated the statutory distributions, percentages, and caps, and established a budget model for the legislature to use in allocating the funds that were in the account. Continuing on the next page, we get to House Bill 3497, which was passed in 2005 and governs what will be happening in the 0507 biennium, as well as what will be happening and what will change in July of 2007. In 0507, there's a 67-33% allocation split between the general fund and between the public safety fund, or where the CFAA revenues are used for public safety programs. Instead, for beginning July of 7, as we said, there are priorities that will guide how the funding is spent. It prohibits CFAA funds to be used for debt service or any purpose not specifically laid out as a priority in statute, and it distributes funds that are not needed for the priorities to the general fund. The next display is a history of general fund and CFAA allocation splits. It is included, it just starts in 2001-03 and shows that it has been fairly consistent under the statutes through 0507 with respect to, in the dark bars are the general fund and the light bars on top are what went to CFAA. Effective 07-09 with the implementation of the most recent legislation, the split pretty much flips and 78% goes to CFAA supported programs and 22% goes to the general fund. The next display is the next two displays are the same thing in two different forms. On page 9, there are bar charts that compare 2005-07 legislatively adopted budget and the 2007-09 governor's recommended budget. The dark bars are 7-9, and the total is $98.4 million of the CFAA that is used for programs. And then the lighter bars are the 2005-07 budget, totaling $38.8 million used for programs. And there is not particularly anything else to point out about this. Clearly, it's a big difference, but we saw that on the previous display. Finally, on page 10 are the numbers behind the bar charts. And there's one other thing to mention about this, and this has to do with ending balances that had been discussed earlier today. In each display for 2005-07 and for 2007-09, you will see an expenditure limitation amount and then a CFA allocation. The allocation will be, in some cases, larger than the expenditure limitation, and this is for the purpose of providing an ending balance to programs that have employees in them and that will need to use that ending balance later on when more is known, becomes known about salary adjustments that would occur during the 2007-09 biennium. For general funded agencies, this is not necessary because there is a separate general fund appropriation that usually takes care of this. But for other funded agencies or programs, as CFAA programs are, there needs to be an ending balance. So that's the difference between expenditure limitation and allocation. And I think I made my 10 minutes. Are there questions?
Representative Hanna. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gilbert, at some point when we're back revisiting this subject of the fines and assessments, will you bring to us the percentage of assessed fines collected?
Chair Shields, Representative Hanna, the percentage collected versus assessed. I think probably Judicial Department is going to be able to do a better job of that.
Just to bring that up during the judicial, Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, because they are responsible for collecting at least the circuit court share of that. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they will be talking about that because I think they have a number of staff increases proposed in their budget around that issue.
But, Representative Hanna hits on a very good point in terms of how much is these funds are we actually collecting, and then you get down to the justice and municipal courts and you've got another kettle of fish to try to untangle. So, but I do think the appropriate question is asked to Department of Justice. My question, Linda, is where is LIMNA? I mean, help a poor, naive old guy here figure out. I thought Lemna came out of criminal fines and assessments.
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, yes, it does. As a matter of fact, there's several things that, no, it's not part of this. I had this as part of the overview and decided to take it out. But there is LEMLA, which is law enforcement medical liability account. There is driving under the influence dollars that are also taken out of Dewey fines. And that is before these dollars. And then there are the Department of Revenue collection costs that are taken out of these revenues before the revenues are then allocated out to programs.
Okay.
And that would be, in 07-09, the Dewey dollars are $223,000, roughly. The law enforcement medical liability dollars are about $843,000. And the collection costs for the Department of Revenue are about $100,000. Statute says up to 2% maximum for collection costs.
And, Mr. Chair, for me,
hello.
On the LEMLA, who is the appropriate department or agency to ask with regard to the solvency of that account and, you know, its functionally demands on the account itself? I guess who administers that?
Mr. Chair, I can answer that. Good. I think Senator Westland, the Department of Human Services is the recipient of those funds and okay. Probably the proper folks to talk to okay. on whether there's enough money and how they're being spent.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Barker.
Can you tell me what that fund is and what does it pay for?
It's an account specifically set up to pay for medical expenses and liabilities of public safety officers injured in the line of duty. I think that's fair enough. And their families?
No. LEMLA, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, is an account that pays for medical costs of folks that don't have insurance and may not be eligible for Medicaid and a whole host of other things.
Injured in.
Yeah. Injured in some type of accident.
While they're in custody.
You're a police officer, right. You smack into the car full of kids in a pursuit.
Thank you.
Is that?
I'm going to have to check if it's only a law, Mr. Chair, members, if it's only a law enforcement related thing, and I'll check on that and get back to you. I don't think it is. I don't want to confuse it with the Public Safety Memorial Fund and make sure I get that one.
Which is officer specific.
Yeah, right. Which is a DPSST operated program. So I will get more information back to the subcommittee on LEMLA.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I do have the statute here as it happens, and it is funding for indigent individuals who have medical expenses while they are in custody of law enforcement.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. First, I really appreciated the information that's represented on page 5. Thank you for that. My question is on page 4, the CFAA revenues over time. When I see the increase in both the light and the dark shaded areas, I wonder how much of those increases is due to increased incidents or activity, how much of the increase is due to when fees or fines are increased, and how much of the increase is accounted for just by simple inflation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, that is a very good thing to wonder. I don't have that information with me, but it's something that we can try to look into. Again, as we pointed out with Justice and Municipal Courts, it's a little more difficult to get at that information, but we should be able to get from Judicial that sort of a breakdown.
That would be fine. It's because some of it is going to happen anyway. Some of it is controlled by what we authorize or allow or change.
Mr. Chair, in some sessions, I'm thinking two sessions, a 2003 session, I think was the last time that there was an increase in unitary assessment. So there are increases because of actions that the legislature takes would be one breakdown, and that has happened a number of times in the past. And then, as you said, there's sort of a natural
increases based on activity. I don't think inflation probably plays into it the same way as it does tax revenue.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, and I may be wrong about this, but we've also passed specific legislation that specifically imposed fines through this process. I think domestic violence legislation 9597 that would have increased the intake, so to speak. So policy legislation tied to specific fines would be another way to do it.
Representative Cameron. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Linda, thank you for your presentation. You mentioned on page 2 about the compensation and assistance to crime victims that there were 6 programs. Can we get some more information on those 6 programs? I know we heard about 3 of them and 3 bills we saw today in judiciary. Where would we go to get that information?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, Representative Cameron, I can make that available. I can talk a little bit about them right now, but if you need to know the specific amounts, then I'd prefer to get back with
you
with those and which programs and which departments receive them.
Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much, Linda.
Mr. Chair, as the next speaker is coming forward, just a couple policy issues to keep in mind with CFAA. A lot of times people think that, you know, they want to use more CFAA as staff people, and others may disagree with our view of the how CFAA is. CFAA and general fund are pretty interchangeable. If you use more CFAA revenues, it means less goes to the general fund and vice versa. Unless you increase the funding for the CFA accounts in some way, where you increase your unitary assessment, policy change, or whatever it is. So really they are interchangeable, and you can see that the governor has really turned it on its side or upside down this time. In the current biennial 507, about two-thirds goes to general fund and two-thirds go to specific programs. He has shifted that. And programs that have not received it in the past now, like forensics and medical examiners, unless it's a long time ago that forensics got it, are now entirely funded with CFA and no general fund. In the current biennium, that's probably not an issue. In future biennium, it may become an issue because if you actually plot CFA revenues against general fund revenues, and the, you know, index them so see how they increase over time, CFAA has not kept up with general funds, and not sure if it over time can keep up with general or the costs that are associated with the program. So you may in the future having to put general fund back into those programs. It's just a policy issue for the future to keep in mind.
Thanks again, Ms. Gilbert, for your presentation. Mr. Prinz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Craig Prinz. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. The Chair asked me through Mr. Wilson to give, this is just a real primer, or I think for most of you it'll just be a reminder, basically, of what the sentencing guidelines are. And I think between the skit or play you've gotten, and I know Doug's done some overview. What I'm going to do is go through this real quick and see, and if you have any new questions, we can talk about those. Basically, I think the best way to understand what the sentencing guidelines are is to understand what they were a reaction to. And so I would take you back to the 80s, and in the 80s in Oregon, we had what's known as an indeterminate sentencing system. And that means that the judge set a minimum and a maximum sentence, and the offender was going to serve some time in between those two, and it was a pretty broad range. And the Board of Parole basically decided in the middle of that range when the offender would be released. So that's really what an indeterminate sentencing system is. During the 80s, basically, their crime went up. There were more offenders coming into the system, and there wasn't more beds built, is the best way I think to put it. And so there was overcrowding. And that meant that that Board of Parole was having to release people well before they hit that maximum time period. So I think the best way to look at the guidelines is to look at it in light of that context and say that it's a reaction to that, or it's a different way to look at sentencing. It's what's known as a determinant sentencing scheme. And so basically, and again, for most of you, I feel like I'm going to make this short, because I know a lot of you have a lot of experience with this. So basically, in 1987, the legislature asked the Criminal Justice Council, which was basically the precursor to the Criminal Justice Commission that I'm the executive director of. The 87 legislature said, build us a sentencing guideline system. And that system is here, and it was approved in 1989. And so that's basically the background of where it came from. And when I talk about when you talk about indeterminate system and a determinate system, that's the difference. So under the indeterminate system, the Board of Parole played a very, very large role in sentence length for a lot of offenders. And under a guideline system, they only deal with a certain subset of felons, a small subset of felons. And many are governed by this guideline. And then we'll talk about kind of what's happened in the 90s and now as kind of an overlay to the guidelines. But so the what I gave you, these are this is the laminated version of the 2006, fully updated, color-coded for your assistance. This is the sentencing guidelines grid. So the sentencing guidelines are administrative rules. Again, they were first approved in 1989, and this is basically this captures what the guidelines tell judges and lawyers about sentencing. Basically, in a nutshell, you have a vertical axis, and on the vertical axis, you would categorize the severity of the crime. So for each offender and each offense, there's going to be a number between 1 and 11, and that's the way we categorize the severity of the offense. And then on the horizontal axis, you have basically the offender's criminal history. And you can see basically what we count in an offender's criminal history is how many misdemeanor convictions that person has, how many prior person felonies that person has, and how many prior non-person felonies that person has. And so that's the way we establish a criminal history. So given the crime and the offender, you find a box on the grid, and that is the sentence, that's the presumptive sentence that offender's going to get. That's basically what the guideline system did. It changed it to a range, a large range, to a pretty definite sentence. So what do all these colors mean? Basically, this black line that goes through the middle here, that there's a little bit darker line, and there's yellow on the top of it, and then there's other colors that I will not try to describe what they're called, because I'll get confused. But the yellow, basically, these are the offenses and the criminal histories where the presumption is that offender's going to go to prison. And those little numbers are the range in months that are that presumptive sentence. So the below the black line, these other colors, those are presumed to be probation sentences. That means that offender, the presumptive sentence is that he or she will not go to prison. He or she will go and be supervised on probation. And those little numbers in there talk about basically how many jail units you have as sanctions and how many non-jail units you have as sanctions. So really, the Oregon Sentencing Guidelines is this grid. I think the important thing to understand where the guidelines is, what they were a reaction to, and then kind of what's happened since 1989. Because when these were established, they were meant to control the sentences for all felons. So you probably learned, I don't know, somewhere along the line, that a misdemeanor is a crime that's punishable by up to a year, and a felony is punishable by a year or more. So this was meant to cover all felony crimes. since 89, we've had big changes in sentencing, but they're mostly, they're all statutory. For example, Measure 11, which was passed by the voters in 94, is a statutory system that is really an overlay on this system. If you were a card player, you would say it trumps the guidelines and controls the sentences for those crimes. And you can see in the little box, we've tried to include the big statutory overlay. So in 94, there was Measure 11. That controls the sentencing for most violent and sexual offense felonies, the most serious ones, I should say. There was also the repeat property offender statute, which was passed in 97 and re-tinkered with in 01. That also was an overlay on the sentencing guidelines. And the reason I point those out is as we go through the session and we're going to start looking at the prison forecast, a lot of those statutory changes have a lot of effect on the prison forecast. So I would say that the guidelines then don't have as much to do with sentencing as they were intended to, or people thought they would in 1989. We've had changes to sentencing. They haven't come through the guidelines. They've been an overlay on the guidelines. To show that graphically, I think staff handed this out. I just put a little. You're probably going to see these. I assume you see these graphs and things over and over. So this one basically is Sue Porter trying to estimate. Basically, what you have here is. This would be, if we didn't have any of the changes that came after the guidelines, this would be what Sue's, what the prison bed impact would be. And so really the guidelines control, you know, last time I checked, it's about 50% of the felony intake. So if DOC has 5,000 intakes a year, the guidelines are going to be about 50% roughly. Measure 11 and repo and felony DUII, our statutory changes that we've made since then, those have affected the prison forecast, and because they lengthen the sentence, those have a lot to do with kind of where our system is now, with how many prisons we've built and things like that. So that's kind of the context of what the guidelines do, what they are not. The other primer thing that I was just going to hit is Blakely, which seems like last session we talked about Blakely all the time. For those of you who are new to this area, Senator Burdick, I could have you do this primer, but what is Blakely? Blakely is a case that came out of Washington that talks about the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. Okay? If you look on the back page of this, you'll see there are what are called departure sentences. The guidelines allow for a judge to go up or down from that presumptive sentence. In Oregon, we have what's called a mandatory guideline system. That means if the judge is going to depart up or down, he or she has to give the fact that they did that, and Blakely stood for the fact I'm using the word fact way too much. That fact had to be proven to a jury if it was gonna make the sentence longer. So you'll hear we did a lot of work with Blakely last session. And what we did is we passed Senate Bill 528. That basically what Senate Bill 528 did is it kept our mandatory guideline system, and it says, you know, if you've got one of those we call them departure factors. We call aggravating factors ones that make the sentence longer, and mitigating factors, we're going to make the sentence shorter. Basically, we said if you're going to have an aggravating factor, you have to prove it to a jury And so Senate Bill 528 basically gave the framework that you would prove those things to a jury. For those of us that are, whatever, lawyers or sentencing geeks or whatever you want to, Blakely was a big deal. There's actually a case that came out today that reiterated that Blakely is what they said it is. It does require those facts to be found by a jury. And so I think, and I feel like in Oregon, we're kind of beyond a lot of the Blakely stuff, and we're looking at different issues like, you know, well, I think our presentation will come later this month. We're kind of trying to look at how should we sentence, how cost-effective is incarceration, and kind of what's the next step. So let's see, I hit the history, what they don't cover, and Blakely. That's pretty much what I was going to cover. That's my primer. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to take a shot at them.
Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quickie, Blakely, a state court or federal court case?
Blakely was a state of Washington case. So it was a case out of the state of Washington, a state case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. Why we were
not not a federal sentencing case. State case out of Washington, which is important
for
us.
But it went to the federal courts.
But it went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right, thank you.
The important thing is that our system is basically modeled on the Washington system, so that when we saw Blakely went through, we knew our system was going to have to respond in some way. Was the answer?
Thank you.
Yep. Senator Burdick.
Well, we also had case law that said that Blakely applied here.
Yes.
Senator Brown was asking, and I remember hearing about the latest Blakely-type case. Was that a state case?
It's a California case that I just read. Well, I skimmed today. basically, California tried to take a run at saying maybe Blakely doesn't really apply. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, again, yes, it does. You either have to give it to a jury to make those decisions, or you have to make your guidelines what they call a discretionary guidelines. That would mean that the judge could say, interesting, you say I'm supposed to send that person to prison for 25 months. That's instructive, but I choose not to. We don't have that kind of system. The judge has to follow the presumptive sentence or give those facts up or down. It's a mandatory. It's confusing when you say a mandatory presumptive sentencing guideline, but I hope that makes sense.
So, Craig, if my understanding is the defendant has the right to either choose a judge or a jury.
Yeah, you can
choose. In this particular case, then, would you have to have a bifurcated?
Exactly. It's a good point. What you have to remember in most every case, and you probably heard this in your skits or whatever, most cases plead out, and the guy and the man or woman who the offender is going to waive their jury trial right and say, "I'll take a deal. I'll plead guilty if I can get that deal." So that takes care of Blakely right there. And then, yes, as I recall, what we did with Senate Bill 528 is we said you can make a choice, jury, you can waive your right to jury and try the whole thing to a judge. What we tried to avoid is where you would do part of it to a judge, part of it a jury, just for all of the logistical problems.
Well,
Senator Burdick?
There are a couple ways to do it. You can have it as part of the charging instrument, it will be included in the trial. If it's an aggravating factor related to the crime, then it would be handled in that way. If it's an aggravating factor related to the offender, then it could be considered in the trial, but it could also be put off till after the trial if it's deemed prejudicial by the judge.
Yeah.
The ones about the offender are, and then if the upward departure is because of criminal history, that's not covered by Blakely. So if someone is a repeat offender and the judge does an upward departure because of that, then that's allowed specifically under Blakely, and that's not covered by this.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, I should have said that you know, presenting some, so the you could see where normally a judge would not allow a prosecutor to go through an offender's criminal history and kind of, you know, because it's usually deemed to be prejudicial. You want the jury to focus on the facts of this case, not kind of this man or woman's past criminal convictions. So normally a prosecutor can't go into the, you know, say a guy's got 10 felony convictions. That's not something that you can talk about to a jury normally. And so that was one of the things we had to figure out with Blakely, when some of these, you could see some of these aggravating factors would be things that we would clearly be what judges would be calling prejudicial. You'd be bringing up for it, juicy good stuff that juries would love to hear about that doesn't really pertain to the facts. And I think what Senator Berta called it was offender-based, or what do we call
offender-based.
Offender-based details. So there still is an opportunity to bifurcate it.
Thank you. Just one other question, and this is, Craig, it's been a while since I've worked in this arena, but my recollection is that Senate Bill 1145, which I believe we passed in
97,
had a pretty substantial impact in terms of how the grid operates.
Yes. This is a great point, too. Senate Bill, you probably all know, this is kind of like reminding ourselves of all these things. After Measure 11 passed, and we had Senate Bill 1 that dealt with the juvenile part of Measure 11, and then we had... That was 95. And then 97, we had Senate Bill 1145. Senator Brown's checking her memory to see if I'm wrong. Okay, maybe it was 95. But you all remember what 1145 talks about is for those offenders who are sentenced to less than 12 months, they're going to do that time in a local jail. Only offenders who are sentenced to 12 months and a day go to Department of Corrections. The guidelines are kind of stuck in pre-1145 world. I'll try to explain what I mean. Look at the line here that says 4. Number 4, you can see there's two yellow boxes on 4 under A and B. And it says, so remember that if it's yellow, that's supposed to be a prison sentence. Well, it says it's 10 to 11 months if the offender is a A by crime seriousness, or 8 to 9 months if they're a B. Practically, as Senator Brown is bringing out, with 1145, judge says, I'm sentencing you to 11 months. You actually would never go to Department of Corrections. You would go to your local jail. And the local jail has a different type of release authority, as you know, or Representative Nathanson knows from being on a LPSC, a local public safety coordinating council. The jail is basically has the same situation that the old parole board had, where they have overcrowding and they have to kind of matrix people out. They have whereas DOC has about 5,000 intakes a year, if you look at all the jails and the number of people going into a jail in a year, it's like 190,000. It's a real quick turnover. So the amount of time that an offender is going to actually do who gets a 10-month sentence is going to really be based upon what county he or she's going to, and it's very likely that he or she will be matrixed out by the sheriff of that county before he hits that time.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, since I'm the one that asked Craig to come forward, I just want to remind folks the little primer he gave. This is one of the major indirect drivers of the public safety budgets, just like what he talked about on 1145 and ballot measure 11. This is sort of one of those things that affect budgets in this area, mainly Department of Corrections or Community Corrections, in terms of the 1145 issues.
Mr. Prince, thank you very much. Any other business before the committee?
Reminders, 8:30 tomorrow is the other side of the presentation that happened at 1 o'clock today, and then tomorrow at 3, Department of Corrections and Oregon Youth Authority will start will do their overviews.
So the 8:30 is different from what we just saw.
Yes, it is an
extension.
An extension.
Okay.
sort of the adult side of it, the non-juvenile dependency side of it.
So, appreciate you being able to be there.
I will regrettably not be able to be there tomorrow because I have a session of the meeting on the open session, so.
Thank you for that note.
Can I just have a clarification here on this long sheet of papers? This is a comparison. I'm looking at 2005-2007 legislative approved. The third column over was mm-hmm. was that 2,878,000,000 that was legislative approved 2007, and now we're looking at 4,074,000,000. We're looking at a $1.2 billion increase over this whole scheme of budget. Is that, am I in the right direction there?
2.8 to the 4 million?
Yeah.
Yeah. 4 billion, excuse me. But keep in mind, of that 4 million, or 4 billion, excuse me, 500 million of it is Owen.
It's Owen, okay.
Yes.
I was kind of thinking.
The capital construction is included in these numbers, so Owen
okay.
is a very large share of that. And that's why capital construction screws things up a little bit. The amount of capital construction in the budget is 45, and then there's some more, a little bit more.
All right. Not seeing any other questions? I call this meeting adjourned.